Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have crazy martinis across the board today. Crazy, crazy, crazy. All of it brought to you by the good folks at Donors Trust. Donors Trust is the community foundation for the Liberty Movement. If you want to support groups committed to limited government, personal responsibility, and free enterprise with your charitable giving, you should learn how Donors Trust can simplify your giving. Go to donorstrust.org/ricochet right now to get your free Investing in Liberty guide. Jim, first crazy martini deals with the now resignation of Minnesota Democratic Senator Al Franken. As most people expected, late Thursday morning, he went to the Senate floor and announced he would, in fact, be resigning his Senate seat in response to the now at least 8 allegations of sexual misconduct, from forced kissing to groping in a number of different instances. But the crazy martini related to Al Franken, Jim, is that apparently a 7th accuser is the magic number for your entire party turning on you. Because when we had 6 Franken accusers, we had a number of people, including Franken himself, saying it was appropriate to go through the ethics committee and due process and determine exactly what happened and then determine whether Franken was still fit to serve. Well, on Wednesday, we got a 7th accuser, anonymous, mind you, who says that Franken tried to forcibly kiss her, and that led to the floodgates. There was actually an 8th accuser yesterday in the Atlantic who said that Franken groped her around the first Obama inaugural as well. And so now we had the Democratic women in the Senate, the Kirsten Gillibrands, Mazie Hirono, Kamala Harris, one after the other, just minutes after each other. Claire McCaskill was in there as well. And within a couple of hours, you had 20-some Democrats, and now we're north of 30 Democrats insisting that Al Franken is unfit to serve. So some believe that the pattern of evidence was just too much to ignore anymore. Others say this is to get Franken off the deck so Roy Moore doesn't have cover in Alabama. What do you make of it?
In the general sense, you can defend the Democratic senators' your decision making. If one person comes forward and says this powerful man did something inappropriate, he touched me inappropriately, things like that. Could this be a false accuser? Sure. And that's one of the reasons you try to go out and find, is there supporting evidence? Did the person tell other people at the time? Were they in the same place at the same time? Is the accuser's description of when and where this happened accurate? Things like that. If 2 come out, it's possible. But it's always possible. False accusations do occur. We see these kinds of things happen. It's an unfortunate fact of life, and so it's one of the reasons that not every accuser is believed when they come forward. 2 accusers, okay, it's possible that 2 people got together and said, we're going to make this false accusation against this person. After a while, though, people start to believe that if there's smoke, there's fire. The good news is that most people go through life and manage to not generate, alienate someone to the point where they would have a false accusation levied against them. This can happen. Again, it's one of those things, but at some point, it's the question of the straw that breaks the camel's back. Now, in the case of the Senate Democrats, as you know, pretty much accurate, they have very little to say other than a tisk tisk, or, oh, I'm so glad this is being referred to the Senate Ethics Committee. The Senate Ethics Committee will get to the bottom of it in about a year or two, is their general rallying cry. And occasionally people would say, oh, we can't have a rush to judgment, you know, innocent until proven guilty, even though that's the standard for a court of law. Franken himself had this very weird, he wasn't going to call his accusers a liar. He remembers it differently. Well, if you remember it differently, then you are, you know, calling them a liar. But the idea that, oh, somehow he remembers this as being this innocent brushing of someone's bottom because of a crowded location and being bumped into someone or something like that, and they somehow remember it as a full-fledged grope. Oh, you know, isn't it amazing how we can have these confusion and human interactions and innocent gestures can be misinterpreted, et cetera, et cetera. The problem for the Senate Democratic Caucus is they went from, yeah, we're not really going to weigh in any further on this for the first 6. But as you said, lucky number 7, all of a sudden it's like, oh, good heavens. The other weird observation about this, and this probably is what makes this the really enormously, the extra crazy part of this crazy martini, Greg. The account in The Atlantic by a woman who was, worked for all kinds of Democratic causes in her life. She had absolutely no partisan motive that anyone could possibly discern against Al Franken. Thought highly of him before her interaction with him, and basically says that he, you know, reached out and grabbed her as they were taking a photograph, which matches the description of several others. And this was at a Media Matters party for the Obama inauguration. Now, two weird things. Greg, I'm sure you've at some point covered CPAC. Could you picture any Republican senator squeezing women at a CPAC party event and nobody around them noticing or reacting?
Probably not, at least not current senators, no.
I suppose it depends how many people are seeing it or something like that. But it just seems very strange to me that basically that he, and I think probably reveals something about this mentality of, well, I fight for women's rights. I'm a feminist. I'm one of the good guys. Thus, I'm entitled to do this. And it'll be interesting to see how Franken speaks today and whether he tries to emphasize, well, I've always fought for abortion rights and stuff like that. So he was entitled to a certain number of free gropes. And I use that term specifically because that was more or less what Gloria Steinem was saying back during the Clinton impeachment. And to their credit, this woman writes in the Atlantic piece yesterday, it's time for Democrats to give this up. This idea that any one of these people are irreplaceable and that somehow that if they, you know, get rid of the creeps in their caucus, they'll run out of candidates to run for office. No, they won't. The world, not only is the world not, you know, lack good men, I'm going to go out on a crazy limb and say that there are some Democratic men out there who do not grope people. I know a lot of people are going to scoff and say, oh, Jim, you're wildly naive, but I'm fairly certain there's got to be at least a few out there who could easily replace these guys. So it's kind of glad to see that there's a comeuppance coming to Al Franken. It is very strange the way it went from minimal consequence to maximum consequence only on the seventh accuser and very little beforehand.
Yes, and everyone reached the conclusion about the seventh accuser almost simultaneously, which is also bizarre. And, you know, that's obviously not good for Al Franken's political career. He's been in the Senate 9 years, but in the end, it's 9 years longer than he should have been there, considering all the shenanigans with his 2008 Senate race against Norm Coleman. So not too sad about that either. Plus, not the most impressive profile in courage since Minnesota has a Democratic governor. So there will be a new Democratic senator. And Jim, if I had to bet, I'm guessing it'll be a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of people mentioning Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith. One of the more interesting political ramifications of all this is that the current Democratic governor is term limited, which means basically every Democrat with big ambitions is thinking about running for governor next year. Very crowded primary. On the one hand, you could clear out a bit of that primary by appointing someone to the seat. Or the Minnesota governor might not want to do that, might not want to take someone and put them in that appointed seat. So we'll see how this shakes out. But again, the idea that, oh, we can't, you know, we can't get rid of this guy because we'll lose the seat. No, you won't. You know, for on the scale of political of, you know, how many votes the Democrats have and however, look, you know, Minnesota does not have a shortage of progressives. It's basically Ed Morrissey, the Powerline guys, and James Lilacs up there. That's it. Those are the only conservatives in the state. So there you go. Maybe Norm Coleman will come out of retirement since he was the guy who lost to Franken the first time. But I don't see anybody see it. No one had 2018 a Minnesota Senate race as being a top target for Republicans next year.
No, certainly not. All right, let's move on to the second crazy martini now. And yesterday, President Trump did what he promised to do during the campaign. And about 24 hours before the speech, we found out that he was actually going to do it. And that is declare that the United States would officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. Here's how that went.
We have declined to acknowledge any Israeli capital at all. But today we finally acknowledge the obvious, that Jerusalem is Israel's capital. This is nothing more or less than a recognition of reality.
And so as a result, we're going to move the embassy.
Consistent with the Jerusalem Embassy Act, I am also directing the State Department to begin preparation to move the American embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
And there we go. But that's not the crazy part. A lot of people like that move. And as he said, it basically acknowledges reality. The crazy part is the people who are upset about this. Let's go to the editorial from the New York Post. Most of the reaction to President Trump's historic recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital was predictable. But criticism from some Democrats was flat out hypocritical. That's because many of those now bashing the move, which includes relocating the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv, enthusiastically supported it when they felt sure it wouldn't actually happen. Such self-professed friends of Israel as Democratic Senators Dianne Feinstein, Richard Blumenthal, and Dick Durbin all criticized Trump's decision. Yet DiFi and Durbin voted for the 1995 Jerusalem Embassy Relocation Act, which mandates the embassy's move to Israel's undivided capital and passed 93-5. And all three voted for its unanimous Senate reaffirmation this past June. Another critic, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker, co-sponsored this year's measure while failing to actually vote for it. So others who voted for that back in the day, including Joe Biden, presidents on both sides of the aisle have called for this, at least in speeches over the years. Trump finally does it. And Jim, you'd think there might actually be unrest in the Middle East because we don't have that already.
Greg, if we move our embassy, there could be violence in the Middle East. We've only seen like 500,000 people get killed in the Syrian civil war over the last couple of years. So look, you know, and all that happened with our embassy in Tel Aviv. By the way, we also should note that, you know, Trump has announced it. It is a big, dramatic and consequential announcement. And the president, who I'm not always such a big fan of, deserves enormous credit for it. Having said that, this idea that, okay, we're beginning the process and he signed another 6-month waiver to help, you know, get all the planning for it. Greg, I've been in embassies. I've been in consulates. Do you know what you really have to do to move it? Change signs and maybe put a desk for the ambassador. It really doesn't take that much effort. You could, let's say, if you can move in and out of your house in 24 hours, you can switch an office from one place. They're not that far away. It's not like you got to load up the moving vans and all that kind of stuff. They could kind of do this anytime they want. The only thing I can imagine is, this has always struck me as the strongest argument for not making this move, security concerns. I have no doubt there is considerable security around our consulate in Jerusalem. If it's an embassy, you have to figure there's a big red bullseye on that building for every, you know, unhinged Islamist yahoo across the Middle East. And maybe you want time to improve the security measures. Do you want to have bulletproof glass? Do you want to put up the vehicle barriers? All the different things you do to try to maximize the protection of a building. And that always struck me as the only real reason you delay this. It was promised by Bill Clinton. It was promised by George W. Bush. Obama never quite promised it, but I went back and checked yesterday. It turns out yesterday he said Jerusalem is the indivisible capital of Israel and always will be. To which somebody said, so does this mean you're moving the embassy? And Obama was like, no, it doesn't mean that. It's the capital, but we're not going to put our embassy in the capital. Why would we do that? Even though we do it for every other country. Very revealing, I think. And the reaction to it today, I think, suggests that a lot of people are like, no, Mr. President, you're supposed to promise to move the embassy. You're not supposed to actually move the embassy. This is a broad bipartisan tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of strong arguments about that, about how much a good portion of the foreign policy establishment, many of these people I have a decent amount of respect for, but who believe in the, you know, the Middle East peace process and how the struggling Middle East peace process. The Middle East peace process is on the respirator or it's in the ICU. Look, you know, Israel is surrounded by enemies that hate it. The Palestinians are utterly convinced that Bill Clinton did his very best to get a deal and put the most generous offer on the table that anybody could possibly imagine, given about 90% of what they wanted. And Yasser Arafat said no. Fast forward about a decade, you've got Barack Obama, who, depending on your perspective, was either anti-Israel or at the very least anti-Netanyahu, and took a tougher line on Israel than any preceding president, and probably the best possible circumstances for the Palestinians. The Palestinians come out and say, yes, but now we want to reach a deal. No, they did not. At the heart of the issue of quote-unquote Middle East peace is the problem that a good chunk of the Palestinian population believes that someday Israel won't exist, that, quote unquote, we will drive the Jews into the sea and that they won't have to deal with it. There won't be a two-state solution. It'll be a one-state solution of Palestine, and that there won't be an Israel. And there's this little factor of the fact that basically every Arab leader who signs a peace deal with the Israelis ends up getting shot, right? There are probably a decent number of Arab leaders who'd like to reach a deal, but they know that their populations would never accept it, in part because they have facilitated this endless propaganda that Israel is at the heart of all of the problems of the average Arab citizen. There are constant Jewish conspiracies, and they're putting baby's blood into the matzah and all these kind of crazy, malicious, off-the-wall conspiracy theories that they've now created a situation where their populations will never accept it. Well, until we fix that, there's no meaningful peace process to speak about. You can put Israeli negotiators and Palestinian negotiators in the room for as long as you like. They can talk until they're blue in the face. They can just keep on going. But until the populations want peace, it's not going to happen. Now, you might say, that's never going to happen. It is worth noting, looking at places like Northern Ireland and the Balkans, people can reach peace when they get tired of fighting and or they realize what they think they're fighting for isn't worth the cost they have paid. But the Palestinians, at least so far, have not reached that point.
Well, Jim, you make an excellent point. I think the recognition of Jerusalem implicitly brings a recognition of Israel existing, and that's why they can't abide by that. And, of course, an undivided Jerusalem being the capital of Israel means there's nothing left for the future Palestinian state to claim as a capital. And so that's why you've got Saeb Erekat, the chief Palestinian negotiator, saying that this killed the two-state solution. And exactly like you said, there can only be one solution now, which is a Palestinian state from the river to the sea, which means the eradication of Israel. So pretty sure that a Trump announcement isn't the only reason why they want that. So let's move on to donors' trust now. It's no secret that the best policy ideas are not coming from politicians. Instead, they're coming from the think tanks, public interest law centers, and other principled individuals and groups from around the country. And the best ones are those that do not rely on government money to operate.
If you want to help move the ideas of liberty forward, invest your charitable giving in those doing the real work of conservative causes. And the simplest way to do this is through Donors Trust. Donors Trust is the community foundation for the liberty movement. With a donor-advised fund at Donors Trust, you will simplify your giving and receive excellent tax benefits, all in a way that gives you an additional layer of privacy. All donor-advised funds offer the same basic services, but Donors Trust is the only donor-advised fund that shares your commitment to conservative principles.
Go to donorstrust.org/ricochet for your free Investing in Liberty guide that gives practical advice on how to identify principle-driven charities that deserve your support. And as we near the end of 2017, Donors Trust is the partner you need. The stock market is booming and the tax code is changing, we think. Donors Trust experts can help you navigate all of this and equip you to give in a way that best benefits you, your family, and the principles you hold dear. Visit donorstrust.org/ricochet right now to download a free copy of your helpful guide. Discover a better way to support the conservative values that you believe in. That's donorstrust.org/ricochet. All right, Jim, a good martini a little bit earlier in the week, in fact, I think it was just yesterday, was the fact that the Russians are banned from the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Not to be confused with Pyongyang, North Korea. They are not hosting the Olympics. But a few eyebrows raised yesterday with the possibility, and it still seems pretty slim, that the United States might not be there either. NBC News, Nikki Haley, America's ambassador to the United Nations, suggested that the United States' participation in February's Winter Olympics in South Korea remains up in the air amid mounting provocations by the North. Haley was asked Wednesday night on Fox News whether sending American athletes was a done deal and responded that the situation is an open question. I have not heard anything about that, she added, but I do know in the talks that we have, whether it's Jerusalem or North Korea, it's about how do we protect the U.S. citizens in the area. The U.S. Olympic officials say they haven't heard anything that would suggest that we're not going, so that's good news. Jim, so I really hope we're not headed towards a rerun of Jimmy Carter and the Moscow Olympics here. Obviously, the North is a provocateur. They've got weapons that can do a whole lot of damage. But with representatives from the entire world there, the idea of attacking the Olympics would put them in isolation that would make their current situation seem pretty reasonable. So I really don't think there's that much of a risk of anything happening at the Olympics.
Speaking as a big fan of Nikki Haley, this is a bit of a confusing statement because it means one of two things. Either North Korea is rattling the saber and they're up to the usual tricks and this is, you know, more of the same. And part of what we've been doing in a dangerous world since 9/11 or even before then is figuring out how to go on with our lives and go about our business and not be paralyzed by fear of what the evildoers and the malevolent people of the world are going to do. But if she's telling the truth, and there really is a decent shot that North Korea would either attack or launch a war or do something during the Olympics. And it is worth noting that Russia did invade Georgia, what we used to call Soviet Georgia in the Central Asia, back during the Beijing Olympics. Everybody was also convinced, nobody's going to start a war during the Olympics. Well, sometimes it does happen. But if North Korea really is going to try to blow up all the world's athletes, We have much bigger problems than we think. In other words, at this point, if that comes to that pass, you almost are like, okay, well, at that point, we have to destroy North Korea because they're extraordinarily reckless. They are too dangerous to be continued to exist with nuclear weapons. I don't know if that's the message she intended to send here. It's been interesting. We heard earlier in the week a little bit of rumors that, you know, NBC officials may not want to go to the Olympics out of security concerns or concerns about war on the Korean Peninsula. Although, Greg, in retrospect, it seems very clear that was merely just a cover story for not wanting to go anywhere with Matt Lauer.
That's a fair point. That's probably a greater threat, or at least it would have been if he was still working for NBC. So bullet dodge there, metaphorically. Hopefully we don't have to dodge any real ones there. Jim, I would assume we're still going to be there. Let's hope that's the case. Talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And don't forget to visit the folks at Donors Trust, donorstrust.org/ricochet, to get a free copy of their Investing in Liberty guide that gives practical advice on how to identify principle-driven charities that deserve your support. And please tune in again on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.